From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, reviewing the UAW's failure to organize workers at the VW plant in Tennessee.
Volkswagen is essentially putting its finger on the scale to help the UAW, and even with that help, they were not successful in doing it.
Plus, the challenge to cities as they try to craft mixed-use zoning laws, opening up neighborhoods without angering residents.
There are really many American dreams. And changing our zoning policy is really about allowing those many different American dreams to flourish.
Plus, thousands of people doing downward facing dog all at once, trying to set a yoga world record at Detroit's Ford Field.
So instead of seeing Calvin Johnson and Matt Stafford up there, you're going to see Eric Paschal teaching the classes.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for joining us on this Thursday. Today, just what do you want your city, your community to look like? Crowded, bustling streets? Quiet, residential, homes only? Zoning laws determine these things. And although the two words alone don't sound tremendously exciting, zoning laws are creating lively debate all over Michigan. We'll find out more on today's show. And then, what was that noise outside today? Did you hear it? Sounded like thunder? Well, in this crazy Michigan weather, we've been served up with thunder snow. We'll find out more about this latest winter delight coming up. But first, to news out of Lansing. The state of Michigan is ending its exclusive contract with the Education Achievement Authority to oversee the worst performing schools in Michigan. State School Superintendent Mike Flanagan has sent a letter to the EAA saying the state will pull out of its exclusivity agreement with the authority 1 year from now. Martin Ackley is with the Michigan Department of Education. He says the state still intends to use the EAA to help turn around struggling schools.
Now, this is in no way a statement or an indication of a lack of confidence in the EAA or its academic strategies. This is just an action that needed to be taken in order to provide flexibility and to provide options other than the EAA in which to place these most struggling schools.
So what are some of these other options the state might use, and what is ahead for the controversial EAA? Joining us now is Jake Neer. He covers Lansing for the Michigan Public Radio Network. Jake, we hear, you know, the Department of Education spokesman saying this move is not an indication of a lack of confidence in the EAA. But I'm wondering, are you hearing anything different when microphones and cameras aren't around or from other people in the Department of Education?
Well, on the surface of it, you could say that it looks sort of bad, especially in the context of a big political debate here going on in Lansing about whether or not to expand it statewide. You know, this is something that the superintendent, Mike Flanagan, the state superintendent, has been saying for a long time that he supports, you know, the legislation to codify the EAA and expand it and so forth. But really, without that, he doesn't have much in the way of options for dealing with schools that are struggling. He says that basically, you know, right now, under that contract, the EAA is the only entity that can take in schools and try to turn them around. But he also thinks that, you know, other organizations might be suited for this, including neighboring school districts or intermediate school districts, which are sort of a local, sort of countywide districts more often than not that provide services right now for schools inside that area. So, you know, basically he's saying, you know, without the legislation, and this has really been fits and starts with that element of this entire conversation for a year and a half now, you know, we needed to just do something. We need to be proactive. Now, there are opponents of the EAA that basically said this is an indication that the department and the superintendent are, you know, acknowledging that this is a bad agreement and that the contract itself was illegal in the first place, you know, going back for a couple of years now.
Well, it is interesting. The announcement comes only one day after half the eight members on the State Board of Education announced they opposed this proposed legislation to expand the EAA to as many as 50 schools over the next few years. So just coincidental timing?
I think it's kind of hard to tell whether or not it's coincidental. A lot of reporters here in Lansing have been talking over the last week, just basically saying that this is one of those issues where the more you find out about it, the more convoluted it gets, the harder it is to tell exactly what's happening behind the scenes. We've been dealing with this for, you know, a year and a half now, kind of really the controversy drumming up. And so it's really hard to tell at this point what's going on behind the scenes. But as far as I can tell, it's just a coincidence at this point.
And is there any indication that the state backing out of this exclusivity deal with the EAA might have any impact on the prospects for that bill to expand the EAA?
Well, if you ask especially Republicans who support the EAA bill, they'll say that it doesn't have any effect, that basically the whole point of the legislation is to, put a framework in place and really clearly define what the role of the state turnaround district, which at this point means the EAA, but under the contract would actually open it up to other organizations. It would provide just kind of a clear path forward for how you can deal with these schools. Basically they say that, when the legislation is put in place, it's going to speak for itself. But at this point, I mean, if they can't pass anything in a year, then things will definitely change.
It makes me wonder for Democrats or those in the legislature who are not fans of the EAA, if this step would, I don't know if embolden is the right word, but encourage more resistance to this expansion bill?
You could actually say that the opposite effect might be true, too, that Republicans who support this bill might be emboldened to try to get this through even more than they were before, because this in some ways puts sort of a deadline for when things are going to change, and the EAA is no longer the only option to deal with this. So Republicans might actually see this as a motivating factor, basically saying, we can't just sit on this legislation forever.
And have we heard from EAA Chancellor John Covington? Any reaction to this letter from Superintendent Flanagan?
The last I heard is that the EAA has not publicly spoken about this, and that they have not even reached out to the Michigan Department of Education on this issue. Something sort of interesting is that just a couple weeks ago, the superintendent actually asked the EAA to end that contract immediately, and the EAA never responded to that. They would have needed mutual agreement to end the contract. So they got the opportunity, like I said, a few weeks ago to break it off right then and there. They never heard back. And as far as I know, the state still not heard back from the EAA about what they think about them ending the contract a year from now. Now, the state can break off the contract unilaterally if they give that year's notice. So that's why it's happening a year from now.
Well, there we go. Well, February 18th, 2015 is the date, and we will be watching this, especially the progress of the legislation to expand the EAA. Jake Neer, Michigan Public Radio Network. As always, thanks so much, Jake.
Thanks for having me, Cindy.
Now for all of us huddled indoors today, looking outside at this crazy, crazy weather. Well, let's close those eyes for a moment and take a listen to this. Can you tell what it is? That is from the western shore of Lake Michigan, from 60 feet up on a ledge overlooking the water, or really, I should say, overlooking the ice. Ice that has begun, as you can hear, to crackle. Meanwhile, in this mix of freezing rain, sleet, and snow, you might have heard another sound. That's the sound of thunder snow. That audio recorded just today by Marcin Szczepanski with the University of Michigan College of Engineering. And maybe that has you asking, just what is thunder snow?
Well, thunder snow is something that is very unusual and even quite startling if you don't know that it's coming.
That's Scott Vuccaro with the National Weather Service.
Thunder snow is associated with very intense snowfall. It's a very dynamic storm system that has a lot of rapidly rising air, and that's typically during the summer months and spring months with your traditional thunderstorm. But in the winter climates, the thunderstorm isn't as high or as tall like you during during the summer months, you might be familiar with the towering cumulonimbus clouds that stretches, you know, for miles up in the sky. You don't necessarily see that in the winter months. It's more of a embedded within a larger storm system that is depositing wintry weather over a large area. But within that storm system, you can have areas of higher intensity, snowfall, and even sleet and freezing rain, for example. You could even have thunder sleet or thunder freezing rain. But in instances, you will have thunder snow, and you will have lightning associated with it, and then lightning then causes the thunder. And at that time, or around that time, you'll also have snowfall rates that could exceed 1 to 2, maybe even 3 inches or more per hour. So that's just a tremendous amount of snow that can be deposited in a very quick period of time.
A tremendous amount of snow indeed as this wild Michigan winter continues. As the world watches the U.S. Olympic hockey teams in Sochi, men's and women's, they're getting a good look at some real made-in-Michigan artistry.
The state of Michigan.
Ensuring quality products today.
The masks worn by goaltenders Ryan Miller, Jimmy Howard, and Brianne McLaughlin are all painted by artist Ray Bishop at his shop in Grand Blanc, Michigan. Ray, this is not your first time at the dance, is it? You have had your handiwork on the world stage at the Olympics before?
That's correct. Ryan Miller in 2010, and actually 2002 and 2006, I had goaltenders wearing artwork as well.
So tell us how it was you came to be the guy that these goalies are coming to for their...
It took a bit of time before I got to the NHL level, but I mean, I started painting masks locally for young players. The story goes, my first professional mask was for the Detroit Vipers, and it was a New Year's Eve game. I was watching. I had already been painting local masks. There was a goaltender in net, had a white mask, and the people at the New Year's Eve party said to me, "You should try to paint that guy's mask." So I started making some phone calls and eventually did get into the Vipers and painted my first professional mask for them.
And haven't looked back.
Haven't looked back.
So tell us what is on each athlete's mask for Sochi. Let's start with Ryan Miller, pride of MSU and Buffalo Sabre.
Ryan's got Uncle Sam on one side of the mask, and he's holding the Sochi torch. Howie's got it's like a more of a Stars and Stripes style pattern, a little more aggressive, you know, make it look like it had a little movement with this blue coming back into the mask and the stars inside of that. Brianne, we ended up using the shield that's on the U.S. jerseys.
Ray, you have had so many years of making art on cars and drum kits and motorcycles and pianos and masks for goalies around the NHL. What is special to you about seeing your work at the Olympics?
I don't think about it a whole lot until it happens, and then, you know, it really just gives you goosebumps, I guess, you know, to think how many people actually can see what something that you've done, a piece of artwork that you've done, and I can say I'm pretty fortunate to have the opportunity to do it.
So as we're watching the U.S. men's and women's Olympic hockey teams, we know we're watching work from Ray Bishop of Bishop Designs in Grand Blanc. Ray, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Zoning laws. Okay, don't start snoring. Stay with me here a minute. Those two words alone might not sound especially vibrant and interesting, but just watch people pour into city commission and council chambers when there's some proposed change to the zoning laws in their neighborhood, and you know things can get lively. Maybe it's deciding whether to allow Bigfoot houses and extra-large garages. Maybe it's deciding whether to permit residential and commercial buildings to coexist in the same area, or how many stories a building might be. What one person thinks is a great, awesome idea, such as allowing more shops and restaurants into an area, might be a horrible idea to a homeowner who wants to come home to a peaceful street. Grand Rapids recently implemented a new zoning policy that allows for more mixed uses. Joining us is the director of the Grand Rapids Planning Department, Suzanne Schultz. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And here with us in the studio is Dr. Jonathan Levine, who's an urban planning professor for the University of Michigan. Good to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
I've seen it in my own city, in my own neighborhood, and with my friends. People might not think zoning laws are an interesting topic, but boy, it's a hot-button issue, and I'm sure you've seen that in your careers. Jonathan, get us on the same page. Traditional zoning laws provide separate districts for different types of uses. What was that designed to accomplish?
Well, zoning got going in the United States in the early part of the 20th century when the evils that were to be combated were the evils of overcrowding, the evils of housing next to polluting factories. So we developed tools to lower densities, and we developed tools to separate land uses. Okay. We need to think about whether or not the tools developed in one era are serving us well for the problems of another era.
Here we are, a century later. That's okay. So, Suzanne, the zoning policy in Grand Rapids changed over the past few years. Tell us what happened.
Well, we had a 1969 zoning ordinance that had been amended over 300 times, and it was based on that model of having separate uses, that everything, you know, had its place, and it was definitely low density in its design. What we learned during our master plan process, which happened between 2000 to 2002, is that the community had a very different vision than what they had in the 60s about having a mixed-use environment, a walkable city, a healthy city. It's interesting that the mention of the early 20th century, it was related around public health, and now really you're seeing everything turn back into a public health dialogue about how do you get people to move and how do you build transit systems and social equity and access to shops and you know, different forms of transportation. And so that vision did not jibe with our current zoning rules. And so we really had to go back to the drawing board and throw out the old code and start brand new.
And was that a hard sell to the community?
No, I think the community really realized it was broken. It was not developing the results they wanted. And when they saw new projects going in, they felt that, you know, it wasn't complementing the existing character of the neighborhoods, that the form of the development wasn't what they wanted. And then if they were going to achieve the goals of better mass transit and having a vibrant retail district or strong neighborhoods, they really needed to rethink all of those old rules.
So what do you have today? How have things changed? Take us to, say, 10 years ago before these changes, and you threw things out and have reworked it. So what are the differences in Grand Rapids?
Well, there's some substantial differences. One is that we have a new form-based code. Form-based means is that you're taking the context of the neighborhood into account when you're creating your regulations. So, for example, if you're in a neighborhood that has all front porches, allowing a house that has the garage on the front to be built right next to those homes doesn't really create a fit in the neighborhood. Or if you're in a retail district, having a building placed at the back of the lot and the parking lot in the front, when you have storefronts that line the sidewalk, doesn't work. And what we had in the old code was the same zone, commercial zone district in the Cherry neighborhood or East Hills neighborhood, which is a very traditional neighborhood context. This, it was the same as on 28th Street or 44th Street, which are much more modern and suburban in nature. So it wasn't fitting. And so the new code today respects the character and the development era of those neighborhoods and seeks to really reinforce them. So we require buildings to be put at the sidewalk now and recess entries and windows on the stores. And even with homes, if you're in a neighborhood, the garage has to be put behind the house if that's the character of the neighborhood, versus in the more modern neighborhoods, you can put the garage there. I mean, that's a typical character of that neighborhood. But we really looked at the context and the zoning really followed. And the community was heavily engaged in the writing of the zoning ordinance, which is a little bit unique.
And this is something that is this kind of a forward-thinking trend, Jonathan?
Absolutely, and we view Grand Rapids as somewhat of a model in the state. What they've done is they've made the good legal. In so many cases, when we look at neighborhoods that we love, neighborhoods that we can walk in, neighborhoods that are sociable, neighborhoods from which we can walk to shops and restaurants, mm-hmm. And we ask, what would it take to create or maintain those neighborhoods today? And the answer under traditional zoning codes is, it's illegal. We've made the stuff that so many people love and the market loves, because neighborhoods like this command a price premium, we've made it illegal with our modern zoning codes. And so what Grand Rapids has done is implemented some important reforms that make the good legal.
Jonathan, when you talk about having neighborhoods where you can walk to shops and walk to restaurants, how do you get that, but you also want to preserve the sense of neighborhood for the homeowner who wants to not have that around or not have worries about too much commercial traffic, or how do you balance the two?
The key is having a range of choices. We often talk about the American dream as if it's one thing, as if all of us want the same thing. Usually, it means a big house on a large lot from which we need to drive everywhere. We assert that that's the American dream. There are really many American dreams, and changing our zoning policy is really about allowing those many different American dreams to flourish.
And the payoff, what kind of payoff have you seen economically in Grand Rapids, Suzanne?
Well, in those areas where we focused heavily on placemaking, which is really what those zoning codes are capable of doing, we have seen lots of new development projects happening, lots of new investment, places where you can't even get a place to rent to live, you know, and it could be you're just off the street from where the new bike lane was installed, or you're just, you know, where that brand new business or the new building is going in, and they already are filled before, you know, they've started building the second level on that mixed use building. So we're seeing huge energy going into these neighborhoods and the downtown that we hadn't seen in decades. And we're seeing new types of development forms being created that we haven't seen for 100 years.
What can be done for the suburban cities? Let's say in the Southeast Michigan area, when I think of the newer ones that don't have the traditional downtown, traditional Main Street, Troy, Novi, can things be done to kind of inject this life into those kind of sprawling suburban newer cities?
So first of all, there have been efforts at developing downtowns and developing main streets in municipalities that don't have them. You know, cities really are in constant flux. When we think of cities throughout history, Paris wasn't Paris. Paris was a small village. We make a mistake in the United States when we think that our cities and our municipalities have a certain form and that's going to be the form forever. I have a colleague who likes counting and measuring walkable urban places. And in Southeast Michigan, he counts three significant walkable urban places. In Washington, D.C., he counts 20 to 40, depending on how you count. But here's the interesting thing. Only three of them existed 20 years ago. So things change, and we have to acknowledge and embrace the idea that change can bring positive impacts to our municipalities.
So the villagers with the pitchforks, when they hear the terms mixed use, that's that. You know, try to be open to change and realize what it can bring.
And there's a lot of potential benefits to the homeowners themselves. First of all, there's benefits to increase their accessibility, their ability to get around and to get places. But there's also property value benefits because the market has shown that it really likes this alternative. Commands a price premium even as it uses less land.
You know, a century ago, Michigan, when these traditional zoning rules came to be, we had the big cities, we had the smaller towns, and we had rural. No one knew what the word suburb meant or what a suburb was. To each of you, if you could look ahead, what do you think the residential and commercial spaces in Michigan a century from now might look like? I'll toss that out to you first, Suzanne.
I think the challenge in Michigan is that we need a major paradigm shift. And the more successful that paradigm shift is, the more successful we'll see Michigan be. And it's really centered around tolerance for parking and your idea of what automobile ownership is supposed to be, which is related to that American dream that was mentioned earlier. What the demographics are going to happen, you know, how they're going to change in the next decade. When you have 10,000 baby boomers a day retiring, and three-quarters of the population's not going to be in the mom and dad and two-kid households anymore. Understanding those shifts, and, you know, you outlive your ability to drive by 7 to 10 years, depending if you're a man or a woman. And understanding design versus density and people being afraid of this, you know, number of units per acre rather than looking at what does the design of the building do for your environment. That transition and understanding those components are really essential for us to be able to move towards a more sustainable future. And by sustainable, I mean the suburban model and this changing environment that we have is not sustainable. We can't pave more roads. We can't pave the roads we have today. We can't continue to build the infrastructure and the types of communities that we have in the past without rethinking what all of our communities look like and how we invest and make those places where you can live your entire lifetime in one place rather than having to go to a retirement community. Or, you know, if you're a young single parent, how you're going to get around to your job or education. And so I think that's the real challenge for us in moving forward is, you know, understanding these and getting the Michigan public to understand that it's about design. It's about not worrying so much about your car as an entitlement, but that we really need to think about how we get around for everyone, and, you know, especially with the changing demographics.
Jonathan?
Well, you asked about 100 years from now, and unfortunately, I don't have any tools to predict 100 years from now, and I would be hard-pressed to predict 10 years from now.
Ah.
But there's a few things that I can identify. First are the demographic trends that Suzanne mentioned. Very, very important changes in demographics, important changes in preferences. So what we see, first of all, with the retiring baby boom generation, secondly, with the kids of the baby boom generation, both of them seem to have preferences for more walkable urban places, less reliance on the automobile. In fact, we're even seeing the young people get licensed at a later and later age.
Very much so.
Nowadays. So the demographic trends will create the demand for the kind of places that Suzanne and I are talking about. The question really is, do our policies allow that demand to be realized? And that's the big unknown. Currently, we have a lot of obstacles to the kind of policy reform that Suzanne was talking about. We have a lot of cities that haven't adopted the forward-thinking approach of Grand Rapids and are stuck in an earlier way of thinking about zoning. Reforming the policies from a standpoint of the law is very easy. It just takes a vote of council. Reforming the policies from a standpoint of politics is very hard.
Yes.
So one of the things that needs to happen is that municipalities need to learn one from another. So when Ann Arborites travel to Grand Rapids and they say, oh, you know what? This kind of zoning produces some pretty nice results. It doesn't produce the hell that
yes.
some people might imagine.
Yes.
That's a process of learning. Other policy reforms could go farther. For example, when the states understand that they have some leverage as well. After all, the states support a whole lot of infrastructure
right.
in our municipalities, whether it's roads or schools. The state can link their policies to municipal policies if the state understands that this is a public policy priority. So the state can actually change the incentive system. And the third and most far-reaching approach to policy reform would be the regionalist policy reform, where local power is shared with regional power in determining our land use policies and our fiscal climate for our municipalities.
Interesting conversation. Really enjoyed having you with us. Dr. Jonathan Levine, Urban Planning Professor for the University of Michigan, joining us in the studio. And from Grand Rapids, the Director of the Grand Rapids Planning Department, Suzanne Schultz. Thanks to both of you for being on the program.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Stateside. Well, it's Thursday, time for our weekly check-in with Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. And Daniel, you're still picking through the rubble of the UAW's bid to unionize the workers at the Volkswagen plant in Tennessee. We know those VW workers said no thanks to the UAW, that the vote was 712 to 626. What do you see as the deeper implications of that no vote?
Well, it's a couple of things. One is, I think, and to me, the biggest thing is that the UAW can't run away from its history. And what I mean by that is it is inextricably linked into what's happened to the auto industry here in Detroit. We've had two very high-profile bankruptcies. We have a city, the home of the UAW, that is currently in the largest municipal bankruptcy in American history. And the UAW has been unsuccessful in its efforts to organize any of the foreign-owned plants down south. And I think that this latest development isn't going to help them. Additionally, they're only representing part of the American-based auto industry. And what I mean by that is there are a lot of other companies that are building product with American workers in the United States. Now, they may be foreign-owned. They may be German, Korean, or Japanese. But they are also building product and selling product to Americans in the United States.
Without being under the mantle of the UAW.
Exactly right. So the UAW really is not representative of the entire auto industry in the United States, and as a result, they don't have the kind of bargaining and what economists call rent-seeking power that they had back in the 50s and the 60s, when essentially Detroit represented more than 90% of the vehicles sold in the United States. Now that number is less than 50%, and as a result, they really can't command the premium wages and benefits that they once did, and therefore it's a much tougher sell for people down south that have a new auto plant, a new manufacturer. You know, Volkswagen has come back to the United States for the first time since, I think, about the late 70s, early 1980s, mm-hmm. when they were in Pennsylvania.
Right.
They've been largely serving the U.S. market out of Mexico and Germany, and now they've got a plant in the U.S.
Well, you write in your column in today's Detroit News that Volkswagen AG's top labor official says efforts to get the UAW into that Tennessee plant will continue, which puzzled me. Is he saying that the union's going to keep trying and the company will stand on the sidelines? Because one might almost think from that statement the company is supportive of the unionizing efforts, or did I read that wrong?
No, I think you read it exactly right. I mean, people need to understand a little bit about Volkswagen. Volkswagen is the largest manufacturer in Europe. It's the largest in Germany. It's also 20% owned by the government, specifically the state of Lower Saxony. And so you've got government involvement. Therefore, decision-making historically has been skewed towards the benefit of the government in that region. Secondly is their supervisory board, which is equivalent to our board of directors in an American style. Half of the membership come from labor. So the guy who I'm quoting in this column is a representative of labor on the supervisory board. They are driving this ship, in a sense, and Volkswagen is essentially putting its finger on the scale to help the UAW, and even with that help, they were not successful in doing it.
That is,
I think what he means by this is they're going to continue to they are going to complain. There are going to be complaints brought. They're going to support complaints to the National Labor Relations Board. The Republican officials down in Tennessee said things they shouldn't have said, despite the fact that management essentially agreed to say nothing, not pro, con. They opened the plant to the union organizers. They said, you can have meetings here. We won't have any meetings telling people the benefits of non-unionization, because they have a different tradition in the German system, and particularly Volkswagen.
Well, that seems like a dream scenario for the union, because you wouldn't get that same, I would imagine, you would not see that same level of hands-offiness from Nissan or Toyota or the other transplant automakers.
Oh, you can take that to the bank. And I think that's why this is so symptomatic. You know, there's an argument, the UAW made the argument, Bob King made the argument, that this winning this vote is critical for the future of the union. That maybe is debatable. I think it's actually fairly highly debatable. But what is critical is their ability to organize other transports. And I think if they can't get it done with Volkswagen, with them essentially standing mute, it's going to be very difficult to do it at Nissan, and very difficult to do it at Toyota or Honda, or probably to some extent BMW in South Carolina and Mercedes in Alabama.
Hmm.
You know, South Carolina is very anti-union as a state. So I think the hope that they're going to get some traction in South Carolina or with BMW management, I would say, is probably not very good, which is why you never hear them talk about it.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes deconstructing the UAW's loss with the vote at the VW plant in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Always good to talk to you. Thanks so much, Daniel.
Thanks, guys.
If you're drawing up a list of businesses and industries that are big players in the state of Michigan, you have to include the furniture industry. The roots go way, way back in Michigan's industrial history. And as we've seen the auto industry claw its way back from death's doorstep to robust sales and good health, we started wondering how Michigan's furniture industry is faring. Michael Dunlap owns Michael Dunlap & Associates, which consults service companies and focuses on issues involving the office furniture industry. And he joins us now from Holland. Thanks for being with us today, Mike.
Well, Cindy, thank you for having me on the program.
Before we get your take on how Michigan's furniture industry is doing right now, can you take us back for some history? You know, how long has Michigan been a player in the furniture business?
Well, actually, every state in the union is at one time or another a furniture manufacturer. Furniture was a very local industry throughout the growth of this country. But Western Michigan and Grand Rapids in particular became well-known as a source of high-quality wood residential furniture, primarily around the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And that continued actually through the Depression. But during the 1930s and then during World War II, much of the furniture manufacturing left West Michigan to go to lower-cost locations around North America. And so much of the residential furniture manufacturing shifted to the southeast part of the United States.
So that was a big hit as far as residential furniture. When and how did commercial furniture take over?
Well, let's talk about it as in terms of the non-wood or the metal furniture industry, which really began to take shape in the early 20th century as America began to build what were then called skyscrapers. But office furniture had been made out of wood, much like a residential furniture. And when skyscrapers came into vogue, one of the biggest concerns was being able to fight a fire. And wood furniture, obviously, it was combustible.
Sure.
So demand started to produce commercial or office furniture out of metal. And companies like today's Steelcase and also Herman Miller and many, many others began manufacturing metal furniture for use in commercial applications.
Now, the 2000s have been tough on many industries in Michigan. How about the steel furniture industry?
The industry hit a peak, really, in the year 2000, Cindy, and it's had a very difficult decade or decade and a half as we're coming along here. The industry hit a peak in the year 2000 of about $13.3 billion in sales nationally, and it actually fell down to about $8.6 billion. It rebounded and then fell again. And right now, the industry is sitting at about $9.2 or $9.3 billion in sales for the United States.
So some recovery, but not back up to the high point.
No, and there are several reasons for that. But one of the things I want to point out and its economic impact to the state of Michigan, of that $9.2 billion, about two-thirds of that come from the western part of Michigan, or West Michigan, is the source of nearly two-thirds of all the commercial furniture produced in North America.
Wow.
We have our own big three in West Michigan, of Steelcase, Herman Miller, and Hayworth. Not many people realize that there's a second big three in the state of Michigan.
That's why we wanted to talk with you. I'm interested. We have these big three selling furniture, Michigan companies. Is it also being built in Michigan, or is there outsourcing?
Well, a bit of both, because many of the companies, Steelcase in particular, is really an international company, as are Herman Miller and Hayworth. So Steelcase manufactures product in Mexico, but also in Saudi Arabia, and they have manufacturing in China. Herman Miller has a manufacturing concern in China. Hayworth manufactures in China and India, and then Hayworth has acquired a number of companies in Western and Central Europe, but most of this manufacturing is done for local markets. In other words, furniture being manufactured in China or India or Western Europe is destined for those markets as opposed to being exported back into North America.
I'm speaking with Mike Dunlap, who's owner of Michael A. Dunlap & Associates. They focus on issues involving the office furniture industry, and we're kind of waking everybody up to who is not aware of the fact that there is a second big three in Michigan, and that's the big three in the commercial furniture business. They are in West Michigan. I'm interested talking about the environment of the places buying this furniture. First of all, the office place. What did the rise of the cubicle in America's workplaces do for these companies? Did it help or hurt?
Well, for the manufacturers, the cubicle or systems furniture is the formal name, was a huge boom to these manufacturers. Systems furniture at one point was responsible for over 40% of the shipments of office furniture, and that has fallen dramatically due to some changes in the way that we work. So there's far less material content being shipped, and people are working differently today. We went through a period up and through the 1960s of we called bullpen offices. None of people were closely tied to each other. They didn't have much privacy. And the cubicle or systems furniture really began to allow people to have more private space. But there's a drawback to that, and that is it created a bit of isolationism. And so people weren't able to work together in the team environments and collaborative environments that we work in today.
So what do you see looking ahead, Mike, as far as the main challenges and opportunities for Michigan's furniture makers?
Well, first of all, the challenge is to be able to sustain, well, really rebound and then sustain the economic situation we have. But the second part is to be designing, manufacturing, and selling furniture that is relevant to the way people work today. I'm a baby boomer, and I worked differently than today's Gen Y or millennials. The needs are different. People work differently. Many of today's workers carry their office in their backpack, and they don't have a regular place to sit. Their office is actually in a laptop or on a tablet computer. So consequently, we have to have furniture that fits the needs of the way people are working. And because people work more in teams, in collaborative spaces, the product has to be made to accommodate that.
A look at the West Michigan furniture industry from Mike Dunlap, who owns Michael A. Dunlap & Associates. They consult service companies and focus on issues involving the office furniture industry. Thanks for talking with us today.
All right, Cindy, and take care.
Picture this. Thousands of people rolling out their yoga mats and getting themselves into downward facing dog, all together, all in unison. That's the vision behind this weekend's Yoga Rocks Ford Field, happening Saturday at the home of the Detroit Lions, and the hopes of getting 3,000 people to form the world's largest indoor yoga session. Justin Jacobs is president and founder of Come Play Detroit, which is organizing Saturday's session. Justin, why yoga and why Ford Field?
Well, we thought that yoga is one of those things that brings everyone together and something that's accessible to anyone. It doesn't matter your background, your age, or economic place in the community. Anyone can come out and participate. And we really want to showcase the city. And we've been very fortunate to develop a relationship with Ford Field and the Detroit Lions. And they realize that there's one of the largest challenges we have on the recreation side is a lack of physical spaces to host fun things to do. So they've been so nice and have donated Ford Field for the day to be our personal yoga studio.
And where are people coming from? As you're taking people signing up, where are they coming from to be part of Yoga Rocks Ford Field?
Well, the majority are definitely from the Metro Detroit suburbs, but we've also seen plenty of registrations from Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, many from Ontario, and even a few from Colorado seem to be flying in.
So to be part of this big event. But you're hoping by getting the people at Ford Field, it's then an opportunity to give them a closer look at Detroit. How are you going to be doing that?
Well, we really want to take this opportunity to bring thousands of people downtown, mostly suburbanites, and showcasing all the positive things going on in the city and kind of combating all the negativity that you see on the news.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing so, we're going to partner up with DHIVE, which is Detroit's Welcome Center, and they'll be providing bus tours complimentary of downtown Detroit. We're actually going to be shuttling in people from all the yoga shelter studios around Metro Detroit, so if they don't want to drive down here, we're providing them a full shuttle service. And then once they're down here after the class, they'll be given a tour of downtown. They'll get to see Eastern Market, the riverfront, campus marshes, and more.
And logistically, how is this going to work? Is one teacher going to be able to lead a group of, say, 3,000 in yoga practice?
That's the plan. Yeah, we have brought in Eric Pascal, the founder of Yoga Shelter, who now works out of California. He's flying in for this event. And he's going to be on the Jumbotrons on both sides of the field. So instead of seeing Calvin Johnson and Matt Stafford up there, you're going to see Eric Pascal teaching the classes.
Well, pretty fun. And getting involved just takes going to comeplaydetroit.com?
Exactly. You can register online at comeplaytrick.com through Friday, or we will accept on-site registrations for $30 at the door.
All right, $25 ahead and $30 at the door to be part of Yoga Rocks Ford Field. Justin Jacobs is the founder and head of Comeplay Detroit, organizing this giant yoga class called Yoga Rocks Ford Field. Good luck with it, and I hope everybody, you know, gets their downward-facing dog all in unison and looks fantastic.
Well, thank you so much. We really appreciate it. We're really excited to be a part of this and be able to do something so unique.
Sounds fun. Thank you very much, Justin.
No problem at all.
And we hope everyone travels safely on their way to Detroit for that epic yoga session, traveling safely in this epic weather. Weather getting some attention from Lansing. The Michigan Senate voted today to spend more for winter road maintenance. The legislation includes $100 million to fix potholes and help governments with higher than usual salting and snow plowing bills. The bill now goes to the State House. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Bob Scon. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Chris Hattlesley, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, and Claire Tennisketter. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk Monday afternoon at 3 o'clock.